Are we ready? Well, I think we can start. And it is a great pleasure and honor to introduce this year's speaker of the annual lecture of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society. Someone who tend to come to these lectures every year, I believe, and other people who experience these lectures would join me in thanking the Foundation for establishing this wonderful tradition to invite the best expert in the field to share with us their ideas. And today's lecture is very much within that tradition, and Professor Dennis Galligan would talk to us about deliver a lecture on the indirect origins of the judicial constitution. Professor Galligan is a fellow of Wilson College, actually vice-gerent of the college. He is a professor in social legal studies in the Faculty of Law and fellows of the Center for Social Legal Studies. Really privileged to have him very closely around, to have chance to talk to him and gain from the wealth of his thoughts and research. Dennis Galligan is one of those scholars who doesn't like to be limited in the flow of his mind, and he breaks all kinds of borders. He is among very few people who try to bring together legal and social in an integrated and meaningful way. He asked very deep and very fundamental questions about law, but at the same time putting them in a deep social context, not shying from what social scientists would believe it's their own domain. He crosses borders between theory and empirical. He is brilliant in discussing theoretical ideas, but he does it with wealth of knowledge of empirical research in the field. And he does practical things. He goes to all kinds of countries and advises on constitutional matters in countries like Pakistan, many countries in Eastern Europe, and countries that I don't know about. And today we are privileged to have him with us and listen to his recent ideas on research on constitutional matters. Thank you, Dennis.
Well, thank you very much, Marina, for those very kind remarks. And it's an honour to give this lecture and welcome to it. If my calculation is right, it will take approximately 55 minutes. So I'll try to stop then. So, in a dissenting judgment of Justice Felix Frankfurter of the United States Supreme Court, delivered in 1943, reveals a point of tension in modern constitutions. The facts of this case are very simple. A law of the state of Virginia required all school children to salute the flag. On religious grounds, the children of Jehovah Witnesses refused, so putting themselves and their parents at risk of punishment, including prison for the parents, reformatories for the children. A challenge to the law reached the Supreme Court, where a majority of 8 justices held it to be unconstitutional. Justice Frankfurter, the 9th justice, dissented. He agreed that the law was foolish and unjust, but insisted that for the courts to declare it invalid would be to undermine the foundations of a self-governing society. Such a society, he said, depends on the vitality of the people and their actively preserving liberal values. Look, he urged, not to the consequences of the law, unfortunate though they be, look instead to its origins in elected government. Elected government, he continues, is accountable to the people, and it's up to the people to ensure representatives do not pass laws infringing rights and liberties. To rely on the courts to intervene, he said, to correct the mistakes of representatives, would diminish the responsibility of the people for their own government. The tendency to regard the law as, quote, all right if it is constitutional, is, he said, a great enemy of liberty. And he concludes, and I must quote his rather long passage, reliance, he says, for the most precious interests of civilization must be found outside their vindication in courts of law. Only a persistent, positive translation of the faith of a free society into the convictions and habits and actions of a community is the ultimate reliance against unabated temptations to fetter the human spirit. Just as Frankfurt now sounds like a voice in the wilderness, his words a plea to save a waning tradition of constitutionalism, a tradition based on active citizenship rather than resort to the courts, a plea to preserve the political constitution from the juridical. His dissent was in vain, for in the 70-odd years since, the tendency to rely on the courts to resolve social issues seems to have grown, while active citizenship has declined. Words, H.L.A. Hart used to say, are signposts to social reality. In the same spirit, the words of a judgment are more than the interpretation of a constitutional text, but show the judge's understanding of the text and of the ideas on which it is based, and so tell us something about the society itself. The constitutional universe implicit in Frankfurter's judgment has several parts. First, there is a line between the political sphere and the judicial, which, secondly, signifies a conception of constitutions where to cross the line would be a betrayal. Thirdly, within that conception, on matters relating to the wisdom, even the justice of laws, the political sphere, not the judicial, is the arena of resolution. And finally, according to this view, it is the arena of resolution because a free people must govern themselves, meaning they must take responsibility for their actions and those of their representatives. And so a cogent conception of a constitution emerges. Yet, just below the surface, tensions soon appear. On the one hand, Frankfurter's image of active citizenship is at home in a tradition of constitutional thought, with its origins in Greek philosophy and Roman law, and its application in the Roman Republic and medieval Italian states. This republican tradition has at its core how free men and women, where being free means being self-governing, can enter into association with others, can consent to government, and still be free. The answer is by direct involvement in government. For government is both necessary and good for society, the involvement of citizens an expression of freedom and self-government. On the other hand, the constitution Frankfurter has to deal with is very different. It is one of representative government, which means the people hand over authority to elected officials and their advisers. This is the form of government embedded in the US Constitution and pretty well every other constitution around the globe, as I shall shortly show. Frankfurter equates the two traditions, sees active citizenship at home in a system of representative government. Citizens do, of course, engage in political action in many ways. But active citizenship is not at the core of representative government. It is not the foundation on which it is built. Frankfurter's belief that the spirit of active citizenship lives on in representative system is not shared by his brother judges, to whom, in their robust striking down of the Virginian law, it was plain that representative government severely limits the power of citizens to protect their rights in the face of foolish, ignorant, or wicked officials. In deciding to intervene, the majority was fortified by the Constitution itself, by the combined effect on the one hand, a representative system in which no true remedy lay open to the victims, while, on the other hand, they had to deal with a declaration of rights and a judicial system which had the power to decide what those rights should mean. So the Constitution itself provides the vehicle for and eases the passage from the political sphere to the juridical, despite the forlorn hopes of Justice Frankfurter. Representative government, moreover, is inherently ambiguous. It may be regarded as democracy modified for practical reasons of efficiency, the natural successor to the classic republican tradition described above. Or it may be seen to stem from a different line of thought, whose origins are in the English Constitution, and which has little to do with democracy. Indeed, in its distrust of the people, may be considered an enemy of democracy. On this approach, representative government is based on ideas, concepts, and practices about the nature of authority and how the few claim legitimately to rule the many. Into that constitutional tradition, elements of democracy have been inserted and absorbed, while the structure remains intact. These ideas I shall develop in the course of this lecture. A debate is currently raging about the proper line between the political sphere and the juridical, between the political constitution and the juridical constitution. Juridical constitutionalism is based on the courts asserting their authority to have the final decision on what rights we have and what they mean. Its advocates, mainly academic lawyers and judges, justify the actions of the courts on the grounds that certain rights are, or should be, beyond the political process. Questions about rights, it is said, have objective answers in finding which the judicial process is more objective, more reliable than the political. Advocates on the political constitution contest both grounds, claiming first that we are likely to disagree about the content of rights, and secondly, that the democratic process is more effective than the judicial in resolving disagreements and more legitimate. This is not the first time such divergent views have been held as to the nature of constitutions, and hardly the last. Now, into this normative debate about the right balance of the two models of constitutions, I shall not enter. However, it's interesting to note the debate makes practically no reference to real constitutions, and that's what I propose to do here. The analysis takes place at three levels. First, to examine the provisions in contemporary constitutions concerning the political aspects, and to a lesser degree, the judicial. Next, to consider the ideas and concepts, the view of constitutions implicit in such provisions, and third, to relate them to the social context in which they occur. I proceed on the premise that the study of constitutions will lead us to ways of thought on which they are based and in terms of which they make sense. The method I deploy is to take a few snapshots of constitutional moments, to see what lies behind them, what the protagonists were thinking, not just the social issues at stake and how to resolve them, but as well the frame of reference from the past, the ideas, understandings, and conventions within which deliberation and decision take place. So, working backwards, my moments come at roughly 150 years, very conveniently. Felix Frankfurter's 1943 dissent is one. James Madison's 1770s urging adoption of the federal constitution, another. And Charles Stuart, King of England, 1642 definition of the English constitution, a third. This internal or hermeneutic approach, which I identify with the historians John Pocock and Quentin Skinner, and with the sociologist Anthony Giddens, is illuminating, but takes us only so far. I want to edge the analysis by placing the hermeneutical circle in a broader context of social events. Okay, turning to constitutions, the number of constitutions in force is 206, give or take a few uncertain cases, and all are under analysis. The results so far show a striking similarity in the provisions made for the people, in how the people are presented and the role they have. Constitutions generally begin with an assertion by the people that it is their constitution, created by them in the exercise of their sovereign authority. The Constitution of India, Japan, and the United States, and many others begin, "We the people," while the Act to constitute the Commonwealth of Australia refers to the agreement of the people to unite. The Constitution of the Republic of Hungary, in common with many others, declares that all power belongs to the people, who exercise sovereignty through elected representatives, or, in brackets, directly. Despite such confident assertions of ownership and sovereignty, the people have a very limited role in these constitutions. They often, but not always, have a role in amending the Constitution, and often, but not always, in electing representatives. Putting aside the amending provision, which is important but relatively rare, the main constitutional role of the people is to elect representatives. So I proceed on the assumption that in the great majority of constitutions, the people delegate their authority to govern to representatives. Now, the election of representatives is essential to the leanest notion of democracy. And between having the right to elect and not, there is a world of difference. Nevertheless, to confine the constitutional role of the people, to the election of representatives is to opt for a very particular constitutional scheme. It is a scheme in which the people have no right to involve themselves in government, in the legislative, executive, administrative, even judicial branches of government. Nor do the people have, as a matter of constitutional right, direct power of supervision over government. The people own the Constitution, but are barely in it. As John Pocock, one of the great historians whom I mentioned before, writes of the founding fathers of the US Constitution, and I quote, "There was a distinction between the exercise of power in government and the power of designating representatives to exercise it. And it could be argued that all government was the people's, and that the people had withdrawn from government altogether." Something of a paradox. Given the constraints of this lecture, I need to make, without defence or argument, a few claims. First, there are a number of reasons for thinking the courts have become, in recent years, more active in constitutional matters, but in the absence of thorough empirical research, it's hard to be sure. This is not how much that shift has taken place is not vital to my present argument, for all I wish to show is that modern constitutions provide a structure which is conducive to a weak political sphere and a strong juridical sphere. My second assumption is that constitutions matter, that they influence the behaviour of officials and citizens. I think they matter in two main ways. Constitutions provide a set of authoritative standards, creating government institutions and directing how they should act, while the people, for their part, use the standards to criticise acts of government and call it to account, also to make claims on government. There is an element of contingency here, for we do not know exactly how much constitutions matter, another empirical question, but it's enough for my present purposes that they have some effect on behaviour. The Constitution matters in another way. It is a window into society, into how its members imagine themselves and the social organisation that results. It shows how they order power and authority, how they wish to be governed and their relations with government. We must not overdo the mirror image, which we know can be distorted, even splintered, so that constitutions can be out of step with social reality. Constitutions both reflect images of society and project back onto society a vision of social relations which influences the reality. So in that way, constitutions and the people's image of themselves become interwoven, which helps to explain why, in some societies, constitutions attract reverence verging on the sacred. My third assumption is that the best indicators of the political character of constitutions are provisions defining the role of the people, as I've mentioned. The more constitutionally protected scope there is for the people to engage in political activity, the more political the constitution. Conversely, the lesser the constitutional role of the people, the more obstacles there are to political activity, then the less the constitution is of a political character. If the scope for political action by the people is narrowly confined, then a constitutional gap results, a gap which other constitutional processes will naturally fill. And that is where the courts make their entry. So the other half of the story is to what extent constitutions allow or encourage the juridical part. And the best indicators of that are the provisions concerning courts. Now my main focus here is on the political side of that equation rather than the juridical, although they cannot be wholly separated. Provisions restraining the political character of constitutions are complemented by provisions encouraging or facilitating their juridical character. that the people reserve for themselves such a limited constitutional role does not quite fit a narrative. A narrative depicting centuries of struggle for freedom and self-government, for democracy and popular sovereignty. Having won the struggle, why do the people then hand over government to a few, reserving only the power to eject them from office? If to that is added the scores of officials and experts and advisers who share in governing, the misfit between we the people, who own and control the Constitution, and the limited role we give ourselves becomes more puzzling. One explanation is that the authority to remove governments by election is enough. There's a world of difference between having and not having the power of election, and the right to elect leaders is an essential condition of a society where the people are sovereign. But why should it be considered sufficient? We know that governments, meaning the full apparatus of the state, become detached from the people, that bureaucracies are hard to control, and that the power of office intoxicates its holders. If to secure good and accountable government is the point of a constitution, there's a good case for the people being more involved, having more control over it. Now, the rejoinder might be that the people have ample opportunities to involve themselves in government, and so constitutional provision is unnecessary. The trouble is they do so by permission of government, not by dint of constitutional right. The imperatives of democracy and popular sovereignty point to the people making constitutional provision for their engagement in and control over government. That would seem to be the natural, logical, and safer course for a free and self-governing community to take. Why then have the people settled for a minimal role in the Constitution? Why have they not entrenched the political constitution? Now, the standard explanation is very simple. Modern constitutions are based on democracy, are the pinnacles of democratic evolution. But, big but, effective government requires the delegation of authority by the people to representatives. Democracy prevails, but for practical reasons, it has to be representative democracy rather than stronger forms. Robert Dahl, a recent voice in a long line of voices from David Hume through James Madison to Joseph Schumpeter, claims that, quote, it was perfectly obvious to the founding fathers of the US Constitution that a, quote, Republican government would have to be a representative government. But is it perfectly obvious then or now? The premise is that modern constitutions would not function effectively with stronger forms of democracy because, to be effective, government has to be entrusted to the elect few, who will be guided by experts and professionals. Now, this is an empirical claim for which, so far as I can discover, good and convincing evidence has never been produced. The practical democracy argument suffers a more fatal flaw. It turns on the assumption that modern constitutions are the fruits of a long struggle for democracy and popular sovereignty, on imagining constitutions as the apex of democratic aspiration and political evolution. Representative government is cast as a perfect balance between democracy and necessity. If this were true, we would witness one of those rare moments of a social institution having achieved its optimum form, so that without going all the way in hailing the end of all history, we should at least celebrate the end of constitutional history. Alas, the argument is based on a mistaken view of constitutional history, a mistaken view of the character of modern constitutions and of the social problems to which they are intended to be the solutions. And let me explain why. 150 years ago, before Justice Frankfurter's dissent, 150 years before that dissent, revealed tensions inherent in the US Constitution. At that time, 150 years ago, the Founding Fathers were designing the Constitution. James Madison, its chief architect and chief apologist, in efforts to win over the people of New York and Massachusetts for the fledgling Constitution, left a record of his views now collected in The Federalist. So Federalist number 1 sets the scene. After affirming that, quote, the vigour of government is essential to the security of liberty, Madison reveals his abiding concern in designing a constitution, namely, and I quote, a dangerous ambition more often lurks behind the specious mark of zeal for the rights of the people than under the mask of zeal for the firmness and efficiency of government. History shows, he continues, that despotism is more likely to result from excessive zeal for the people's rights than from firmness and efficiency of government. Several essays later, in Federalist No. 10, Madison draws attention to a second concern, the violence of factions. This he links to his earlier preoccupation, for the most dangerous faction is the majority. The majority and popular governments encourage majorities. Majorities threaten the public good and private rights. And to prevent that happening is the great object of constitutions, according to Madison. Since the formation of factions is endemic in society, the task for constitutions is to control its effects. That is not done by direct democracy, but through republican government. And so we have the pillar of constitutional design, republican government, which for Madison means representative government, a government, he says, in which the scheme of representation takes place, a government in which is delegated to a small number of citizens power of government. This version of republicanism contains two seminal ideas. One is that a small number of citizens, the government, must be elected by the people, an idea for which we go to Federalist No. 39. Republican government, explains Madison, means essentially government which, quote, derives all its powers, directly or indirectly, from the great body of the people. That is to say, is elected government. And that is a major difference between it and the English Constitution recently repudiated in that part of the world. The other idea concerns the relation between the people and the elected few. Madison continues in an enormously important passage. He explains, the virtue of representative government is to refine and enlarge the public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens whose wisdom may best discern the true interest of their country and whose patriotism and love of justice will be least likely to sacrifice it to temporary or partial considerations. Under such a regulation, he goes on, it may well happen that the public voice, pronounced by the representatives of the people, will be more consonant to the public good than if pronounced by the people themselves. End of quote. So, government must be elected by the people, but once elected, the chosen few govern, and the people have no role. Now, in a very fine study of representative government by Bernard Manan, he contends that Madison invented the notion of representative government. I would put it differently. Having good reasons for exploiting the language of republicanism, Madison invented a new definition of republican government, which combines government by the people with representation. A masterly stroke. He manages to invoke the republican tradition of Polybius, Rome, and the Italian republics, which celebrates self-government, an act of citizenship, while at the same time taking refuge in the notion of representation, a notion which has its roots in the English Constitution, where it has nothing to do with popular election, and is designed to keep the people out of government. Madison presumably was convinced of the authenticity of his invention and its utility in combining popular government with wise and effective government. 150 years later, Justice Frankfurter kept faith with the Madisonian standard, but in the face of unwise government by the few, the people were powerless. Powerless because they could act only through representatives. But since representatives were the problem, the much-flaunted republican part of representative government turns out to be feeble and ineffective, and in the race for constitutional space, inferior to the courts. Turning the clock back another century and a half lands us in England of the 1640s, by chance a time of great turmoil, culminating in civil war and the execution of a king, and a time of constitutional fervour. Brief attention to just one incident opens a window into that world and reveals its constitutional secrets. It also shows the nature of the English Constitution and the mode of constitutional thought inherited by Madison and living on in contemporary constitutions.
On the 1st of June 1642, Charles Stuart, King of England, Wales and Scotland, by now at war with parliamentary forces, replied to the 19 propositions put to him by both Houses of Parliament. Their purpose was to obtain for both Houses a fuller role in governing the nation, including approval of appointments to high office. His Majesty's answer sets out the King's account of the English Constitution, a rare occasion. English government, he says, is a happy mixture of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. Our ancestors, being aware of the inconveniences and conveniences of absolute monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, have, quote, moulded out a mixture of the three, without the inconveniences of any one, a happy constitution. The answer goes on to explain the goods and ills of each, the good of democracy being, quote, liberty and the courage and industry which liberty begets. The ill of democracy, on the other hand, being tumults, violence, and licentiousness. Surprise at the word democracy, which to a 17th century Englishman meant anarchy, is offset by warning of the risk it poses. The people are condemned as Jack Cades and Wat Tylers, who, to quote the king, if set up for themselves, will reduce this splendid and excellently distinguished form of government to a dark, equal chaos of confusion. Let us just pause to take note of the similarities between this approach to the people and Madison's. The 17th century language is more direct, the imagery designed to quell enthusiasm for constitutional experiment, but the message the same. The people must have a voice in government, have to be included in the Constitution, but beware of them and confine them, for they pose a threat to the social order. How then are the people to be both included and confined? If they put the constitutional order at risk, are the dark shadow looming over it? How can democracy be admitted as one of the three elements of the Constitution? The riddle is shrewdly solved. The first part of the solution is to restrict the power of the House of Commons, the democratic element. It may be, as Charles says, an excellent conservator of liberty, but, he goes on, it was never intended for any share in government or in choosing them that should govern. How the Commons so restricted in its role could protect liberty is not made clear, but let's put that aside. The second part of the solution is crucial. In answer to the question, in what sense is the Commons democratic? Given an electorate of about 20% of adult men and no women, Charles flourishes the key to the English Constitution, the concept of representation. The Commons represents the people in the special sense that it speaks for and on their behalf and is the only voice through which they may constitutionally be heard. The Commons is not the agent or delegate of the people, as the normal meaning of representation would suggest. Instead, the Commons represents the people in the sense that it stands for them, is their embodiment, so that when Parliament is assembled, the people in their representatives are also present. Notice that idea. The people have not left the constitutional stage. They've been recast, given a new part, in a manner that marks a parting of the ways of classical republicanism. On the one hand, where the people, the real people, with diverse ideas and interests, are active participants. On the other hand, representation, where the people, now singular, not plural, becomes a distinct entity, a kind of corporate entity, for which its representatives have plenary authority to act. The result is that the people, as a corporate entity, is at the heart of government, while the people, as real persons, disappear. Within the discourse of the people as a corporation, the authority of representatives is not tied to election. Consent of the members of the corporation to their representatives is necessary, but may be obtained in a variety of ways. Both king and lords represent the people and govern on their behalf, while the very notion of the king in Parliament, a notion we still regard as the nub of the British Constitution, is the ultimate representative of the corporation of the people. These ideas were not invented by Charles in 1642, nor by his advisers Culpeper and Hyde. All acted within a mode of thought and discourse long embedded in the English Constitution. In conceding to the House of Commons a role in preventing and restraining the power of tyranny, as Charles described it, a role that might require restraining the actions of the monarch, Charles conceded more than the Constitution required, perhaps in the vain hope of avoiding war. He had, after all, just governed for 12 years without summoning Parliament once. What then were the main concepts of the early modern English constitution, and how can they be relevant to contemporary constitutions? The answer to the second part should be plain. The way the people are presented in contemporary constitutions, and hence the scope of the political sphere, has its origins in Madison, who inherited a way of thought displayed in the words of Charles Stuart, whose frame of reference in turn was a constitutional tradition of long endurance. Much has changed, but much has stayed the same. And in order to see the interplay between the past and the present, a glimpse of the past, of that tradition of constitutional thought that both Charles and his adversaries took for granted, may be worthwhile. The main ideas are threefold: the organic constitution, fundamental law, representation and consent. The organic constitution. Chief Justice Marshall of the United States Supreme Court, writing in 1803, states the modern view of constitutions, and he writes, "All those who have framed written constitutions contemplate them as forming the fundamental and paramount law of the nation. History abounds with written documents setting out parts of the fundamental law, but the idea that the whole constitution can all be contained in a written document was quite novel. That view of the Constitution now prevails, and we may note in passing has opened the way for the courts to take charge of its interpretation." Constitution came only recently to be viewed in this way. In English history, constitution means something different. It was organic in the sense of being tied to, is in perfect harmony with, the social and political structure of the nation. Men of affairs spoke of the body politic by analogy to the body natural, and of constitution as the state of health and well-being of the body politic. Bodily imagery in describing the nation dates back at least to John of Salisbury in the 13th century, who was precise in matching each estate to a bodily organ. The parliamentary complaint of the 1640s was that after years of personal rule, the English nation was in poor health, poor constitution, and needed to be restored to good health. Stephen Marshall spoke in the Commons of Parliament's purpose being to restore the nation, quote, "to the fundamental and vital liberties, the propriety of our goods, the freedom of our persons." Parliament becomes the physician whose task is to care for the patient, whose body is distempered, and to restore it to health. When the Levellers appear on the scene, they use the same imagery to criticise Parliament for perpetuating the nation's ills rather than curing them. The body politic is in good constitution when it is governed for the common good, which is to say, for the safety and welfare of the people and in accordance with the law. Law was vital to the health of the nation, to its good constitution. Men of the 17th century, writes Margaret Judson, a wonderful historian of the crisis of that time, held a profound belief in the importance of law. Edward Sexby, a Leveller, branded a dangerous radical intent on destroying the Constitution, was one of those men. He describes law, little unusually for a radical, as essential to social life, contends that we achieve social life only by subjection to the law. Laws, he writes, are the nerves or sinews of every society or commonwealth, without which they must necessarily dissolve and fall asunder. Why are laws so fundamental to the health of the nation? Why are they things of constitution, as an anonymous author wrote, which constitution, he goes on, is written in the very heart of the republic? The answer is that laws are not just instruments to social ends, they also constitute the society, in defining the rights and duties of the people, and relations between the people and the crown. The first duty of the king is to govern for the welfare and safety of the people, the salus populi, and laws express that salus populi, define what constitutes the safety and welfare of the people. The English constitution is law-based, yet the sense of law is elusive. It goes beyond positive law, whether common or statute, to include general standards of the kind declared in Magna Carta. Even that does not capture the full sense of law, for, as that anonymous writer declares, law is written in the very heart of the Republic, far firmlier than can be by pen and paper. Final appeal is to that innate sense of an Englishman's rights and duties. So when the levellers go in search of fundamental law, they end up with no more or less than law as the right reason of Englishmen. Elusive though fundamental law may be, its point should not be lost. It means that the English nation, from its early origins, ordered social relations through law, and so through rights and duties. Important social issues were resolved by appeal to law, rather than by political action. The English constitution, from its medieval origins, has been a rights-based constitution. The idea of fundamental law and fundamental rights may seem alien to a mainly unwritten constitution, and its study has been neglected. The notion of parliamentary sovereignty abets such neglect, for it leads us to suppose a vigorous political sphere, a political constitution, when the opposite is the case. In making law the nerves and sinews of the body politic, respect for law is the sign of good government, and good constitution, and resort to law the remedy for poor constitution. Authority is entrusted to the king, declares Charles, and I quote, to preserve the laws in their force and the subjects in their liberties and properties. Law guides kingly authority. It also has another use, to criticise, even challenge kingly authority. The complaint of the Leveners, well, first the king and then Parliament, was acting arbitrarily and in breach of the law. In the 17th century, resort to law did not mean necessarily resort to the courts, but by placing law at the centre of the constitution, it created a structure, a constitutional climate, into which the courts could easily slip. John of Salisbury, back in the 13th century, warned that unless the feet of the body politic, and you can guess who the feet were, the common people, unless the feet were looked after, the body, whose nobler parts were inhabited by the higher orders, would have to crawl along on its belly. Notable in the history of the feet is a running tension between, on the one hand, the need to rule in the interests and with the consent of all, and on the other hand, the attitude of the ruling orders to the common people. Charles Stuart's calling them a many-headed monster, intent on creating that dark, equal chaos of confusion, or Oliver Cromwell's dismissing them as mere breathers, whose voice in elections would lead to anarchy, are hardly in the spirit of the saintly John of Salisbury, but they are typical. Nevertheless, the most hardened monarch knows care must be taken of the feet of the body politic. Kings over centuries swore an oath, the basis of which is, quote, the willingness of the people to accept the person about to take the oath as king. And yet, the people had no say in appointing king and lords, and only a small fraction of them in electing the commons. Nor did they have any say in the legislative, executive, or judicial processes. Kingship is the concept at the centre of the English constitution. Kingship means rule as opposed to sheer coercion, and rule implies the consent of those ruled. Attempts at rule without consent rely on force and are doomed to failure. But how do the people consent when they have no say in who rules or how they rule? The answer lies in representation. Representation I've already touched on. The proclamation on the succession of James I in 1603 makes plain its meaning. It goes, in this High Court of Parliament, where the whole body of the realm, and every particular member thereof, either in person or by representation, are by the laws of this realm deemed to be personally present. Since the people are present in Parliament, there can be no gap between the people and Parliament. The Acts of Parliament are the Acts of the people. As Thomas Smith wrote a few years earlier, every Englishman is entitled there to be present, and the consent of Parliament is taken to be every man's consent. The idea was not new. The proclamation was drawing on standard constitutional thought, in which from medieval times, it was assumed that the leading men represented the whole of the community. Now, in order to grasp this notion of the people consenting through their representatives, we must look at two issues through the lens of the 17th century. First is the idea that election by the people is the normal and legitimate way of appointing government and hence signalling consent. That idea was foreign to the 17th century. There, the overriding concern was good government, which means government for the common good, where the king and council, later king in parliament, know what amounts to the common good and can be trusted to achieve it. In this organic whole, the people have neither cause nor space for political action, because their welfare is guaranteed. In this harmonious universe, the rulers represent, even embody, the nation as a whole. The idea that every man had to be involved in choosing the leaders simply did not enter into the way of thought. Between the constitutional universe and social reality, harmony prevails, by definition. If they should fall out of step, as they occasionally did, the ultimate sanction was that the feat could come to a halt. Now, the other idea that we must adjust in looking at the 17th century, which is still to some degree present in modern constitutions, is that of the people as a corporate entity, as universitas, which has an identity separate and distinct from its members. The welfare of the people is the welfare of the corporation, the people as a whole, as opposed to the welfare of individual persons, who together make up the peoples. The corporate notion of the people was taken for granted, was the way men of affairs thought. The notion they had in mind when they spoke of the people, made claims on the people's behalf, wielded power in their name. The people as universitas has its origins in Roman law, was imported into medieval canon law to solve problems of authority within the church, and from there found its way into secular constitutional thought. Once the people is understood in the corporate sense, some of the puzzles of representation and consent dissolve. The corporation of the people, being an entity distinct from its members, can act only through its representatives, whose acts are the acts of the corporation and so of the people. Claims by the monarch and later king in parliament to represent the people and to govern with their consent now make sense. How they are appointed is not the point. What is important is that once appointed, they are the voice of the corporation and its only voice. When king, lords and commons come together as king in parliament, they represent the corporation of people and their actions are the actions of the people. Since the people are already in parliament, there is no other body in which sovereignty could lie. So the point of my earlier claim that parliamentary sovereignty does not ensure a vigorous political sphere is now clear. By substituting constitutionally the corporate entity of the people for the real people, the political character of the constitution is diminished. We now have an account of the origins of representative government and its consequences for the political constitution. But many questions remain. Why this way of organising government? How did English society settle on these ideas and concepts? Why do they linger on in contemporary societies? These are large and complex questions, and all I shall do here is establish some links between representative government and the social context in which it flourishes. Looking back over constitutional history in England as the cradle of representative government, and given the plain link between constitution and property, we may be tempted to settle on a materialist account. Among many signs of that link between constitution and property, the encounter at Putney Church in October 1647 between Oliver Cromwell and Henry Ireton on the one hand, the Levellers on the other, is very revealing. Colonel Rainsborough, a Leveller supporter, argues with moving simplicity the case for the soldiers, the ordinary men who, having fought for Parliament and won the Civil War, now seek a say in electing the Commons. Ireton's rebuttal is brutal in its precision. In lacking property, he says, the common soldiers lack that permanent interest in the nation, which is the basis for the vote. The reason is, in Ireton's own words, and I quote, "The most fundamental civil constitution of this kingdom is above all the constitution by which I have my property," unquote. since the social order is based on property, on the rights of the few to own to the exclusion of the many, the constitutional landscape is one of property, the protection of which is the first duty of the Constitution. And the best protection of property is to keep the lower orders out of government. The link is plain, but the explanation it offers partial. If the Constitution were nothing but a way of protecting property, it is hard to see why the people, largely without property, would accept it. There must be other social factors at work, other reasons for acceptance, and those factors and reasons are likely to be reflected in the Constitution. John of Salisbury, whom we noted was fond of body imagery, warned the rich and powerful that they must look after the feet, that nothing is more ignominious than the barefoot republic. How the rich and powerful managed the feet, how they earned and retained the consent of the people, is a complex and fascinating tale of English constitutional history. The socio-legal question, then, is the age-old one posed time and again through constitutional history. What are the conditions of legitimate authority? Under what conditions do the people consent to power? In trying to answer, I suggest two lines of argument. One looks to the scheme of ideas and values at whose centre is representation, of which we have seen the force. Representation, and all it signifies, is often dismissed as a fiction aimed at legitimating a particular kind of social order. That may be true, but it can also be understood differently, as a complex system of norms and values based around the notions discussed: consent through representation, social harmony displayed in the organic constitution, fundamental law and rights under law, and rule for the common good. The ideas, the rhetoric, and the symbols are all engaged in creating a morally compelling order, in which all have a place in society and hence in the constitutional order. Nowadays, we need to adjust the scheme of ideas in various ways, adding election as an essential condition of legitimate authority, but otherwise not disturbing unduly the scheme of ideas inherited from the past. The scheme of ideas has much efficacy in legitimating authority, but, as John of Salisbury, shrewd old sage as he was, as he shrewdly saw, ideas, while critical, are not enough. As well as being a member of a body of good constitution, the feet must be shod. If the power of the people is to be accepted by the many, it must deliver certain social goods, some material, such as stability, security, and prosperity, others cultural, such as liberty, equality, and the rule of law. To take something of a turn, let's go to the social historian, the French social historian, Fernand Braudel. Braudel has written that the one problem occurring most frequently in Europe between the 5th century and the present is the struggle over libertates, not liberty in the modern sense, but privileges, or in modern parlance, rights. Rights include such matters as being free to own property, engage in commerce, enter the professions, when historically such matters were restricted by class, group, or guild. Once the barriers to access are removed, once these and other negative rights are secured, it's natural that claims should be made on other social goods, positive rights to social and economic goods. Now, Braudel's thesis is a very grand one, depends ultimately on the evidence. But it is suggestive on two points. First, that the quest for social justice and the benefits that result is a basic force in society. And secondly, that force competes with, even eclipses, the urge to gain control of government and create the political constitution. Half a century before, Max Weber, in sketching out a sociology of democracy, put forward the intriguing thesis that the decisive, indeed exclusive his own word, in democracy is, and I quote, the levelling of the governed in the face of the governing, the levelling of the governed. Is the word levelling chosen, I wonder, for its historical resonance as a common term for condemning popular movements? Weber's idea is that the main and perhaps natural direction of popular movements is more and more levelling, which means the people making more and more demands on government. Reducing inequalities easily shifts into demands for the positive provision of social goods. Weber's sociological thesis fits well with Brodel's broad historical brush, and both need further investigation. But both fit well within the structure of modern constitutions. Both help to explain why constitutions offer only weak protection of the political sphere. On this sociological account, democratic movements are primarily about the equal distribution of social goods, about what social goods government makes available and how they are to be distributed. The process of government, who governs, has a lesser sociological role. We might use this also to explain the prominence and vigour of the juridical side of constitutions. If gaining and maintaining legitimacy depends, historically, on governments providing social goods, then it is to be expected that the more valuable of them should be given the protection of law, which is precisely what we see in the English Constitution, from Magna Carta to Chief Justice Marshall's modern constitution. And so we may conclude, when excavated in this way, modern constitutions reveal their secrets, open a window into the past, show that the people have always had a place in the constitution, confirm that they value a host of social goods, but most of all, allow us to understand a little better the balance between the political aspects and the juridical. Thank you very much.